Hello, this is John Sifferman with part two of the interview with Scott Sunnan. In the first interview, we heard a lot about Scott's background and what ultimately shaped him into becoming one of the world's leading health professionals. We also discussed the importance of a regular mobility program and how to get started immediately. During today's call, Scott will be diving into some fun topics like club bell training and prasara yoga. So we'll get into the real manna of circular strength training. So it's my pleasure to welcome Scott Sunnan back with us. Welcome to the call, Scott.
Thanks, John. I appreciate you inviting me back.
Absolutely. So let's dive right in. I got a lot of great questions, and we're going to start with club bell training. I'd like to know what makes the club bell so unique and effective from the inventor himself.
Do you mean uniqueness from, say, other types of strength training or uniqueness from other types of weight swinging?
Other types of strength training.
Okay. Well, it's the opposite direction then. That's the simplest way to explain it. There are other modalities like club bell swinging, but in general, and this is a strong generalization because you can use other pieces of equipment outside of the context of their intended use, but in general, traditional weightlifting is used for compressive force, meaning the weight pressing down toward gravity or pulling down toward gravity causes a stimulation in bone growth, and as a result, there are also ancillary benefits to muscle and connective tissue strength. I'm looking at this purely from a health perspective. So when people lift weights just to increase muscle size and density, that is a skewed perspective from my approach. I have a health-first approach to exercise. So, yes, you can focus weightlifting on just increasing muscle size, but from a health perspective, you should start at the lowest level, the bone density increase first, and then work from bones to skin. So weight lifting is typically compressive forces, and by pressing down, you stimulate the osteoblastic effect, which increases bone density and offsets the progress of osteoporosis as we age or due to lack of sufficient stress upon the body, which is what I was exposed to in the former Soviet Union. Their cosmonaut program early on discovered that you can't lift weights in zero gravity. I know that's, of course you can't, but you don't think of it in advance. And you don't realize that when you send someone into outer space, their body begins the process of rapid decay because there's no stress acting upon the body. As a result, the bone becomes very porous, very brittle, as do the muscles and the connective tissue. So traditional weightlifting was focused on capitalizing upon gravitational attraction. What happens when you don't have gravity? Weightlifting is useless.
Right.
So the opposite end, the opposite focus is the target of club bell swinging. Club bell swinging uses traction and torque in order to separate the bones. Again, let's look at this from a health-first perspective. Let's go from bones to skin, from inner bag to outer bag. First, we need to pull the bone apart. Now, the studies show that traction accelerates bone growth faster than compression, which is why when we go to the hospital, they place us in traction, because that stimulates the osteoclastic-osteoblastic effect, where the little bone creatures set about, tearing down bone that's not helpful and putting up bone that is helpful. So pulling apart the bone is the focus, the beginning focus of weight swinging, or club bell swinging in this case. So by pulling apart the bone, you stimulate greater bone density faster than you would compressive forces. But see, here's where the change is, and this is really an interesting phenomenon. I'm not against compressive forces. I actually use them. And there are compressive forces, compressive force elements even in club bell swinging due to some of the exercises and some of the movements in their relationship to the gravitational field. For instance, the shoulder park squat is a compressive force, But traction and torque pull away from the body in such a way that's opposite of what happens with compressive forces. So when we're separating the bone and when we're pulling on the connective tissue, they lay down microfibers. The muscle becomes more innervated, becomes denser, becomes stronger, and as a result, you know, you also have a cross-section increase in muscle size. But this is what's fascinating. I keep begging this point, but by pulling apart the bone, you also cause traction to the joints. So you create space. Creating space increases synovial flow and increases synovial flow is the for the readers and listeners that may not know. As I didn't, that when you have compressive forces acting upon the joints, it squeezes out the synovial fluid between the bones, where two bones are conjoined by a bag in order to make them operable in the fluid body. You have it filled with a nutritive and lubricative flow we call synovial fluid. And not just between the joints, but around the bone. So underneath the periosteum, the inner bag, that cellophane-type wrap around the inner bag is supposed to be another fluid, like synovial fluid, called ground substance. That fluid body is what is our animating force. It's what gives us shock absorption. It's what gives us the ability to absorb and retranslate force. It's what gives us our nutrition in every joint except our jaw, since every joint except our jaw after puberty receives nutrition only from movement, since there's no capillary flow there any longer. There's no blood flow. There's no nutrition. So dynamic flexibility, for instance, is not a sufficient way to prepare the body for a warm-up, since dynamic flexibility is only increasing local circulation. You also have to create space in the joints. Okay, so back to the point. So weight swinging not only increases the bone health as well as fascial density and muscle size and strength, but it causes traction by pulling apart the joints and creating space so that the body's action, and I think it's Gray Cook who developed reactive, I can't remember the acronym, but it's a technique of, say, my knee drops in when I'm throwing a baseball. So by wrapping a band around my knee and pulling it in more, my knee automatically pushes out to where it should be in order for me to have proper structure. So the same technique is involved here. If I have traction in my joints, the connective tissue pulls back and grows stronger so that I have tighter joints, not loose joints. This is different than flexibility. Flexibility holds it, causes a permanent adaptation, I should say. Traditional static flexibility training causes a permanent adaptation in ligament and tendon length, which makes for loose joints, which is bad. Because for athleticism or daily function, if you have loose joints and you have to suddenly change direction or suddenly go under load, the joint gives out, not the muscle. So this weight swinging effect pulls back on the joint, creates stronger joints. Compressive forces, if done to the exclusion of weight swinging or any type of traction to the joints and to the connective tissue and bone, compressive forces keep the synovial fluid out. They squeeze out our fluid body like wringing out a sponge and then keeping the sponge completely clenched. As a result, yes, you can increase bone density and you can increase muscle size and fascial density, but at the expense of the connective tissue, the attachment and insertion points of the outer bag of the fascia, myofascia, the muscle and the fascial tissue that attaches it to the inner bag, the periosteum and the joint capsule. So what do you have? You have bodybuilders and powerlifters. And when I say bodybuilders and powerlifters, I don't mean just recreationally. Or I don't mean just competitively. I also mean recreationally. Those people who are trying to become stronger from a traditional perspective or bigger from a traditional perspective typically are amateur bodybuilders and powerlifters. So when you only do amateur or professional or competitive bodybuilding and powerlifting, you're fraying the connective tissue at the insertion or attachment points because compressive forces squeeze out the synovial fluid, cause the fraying, and as a result, there's no re-gluing down. There's no recovering process where the fluid body pulls down the cotton candy fibers that have been caused from microtrauma. So with no lubrication, no nutrition, yes, they become bigger, but they get tiny joints, they get frail joints, and when I say joints, I mean connective tissue. I don't mean, the joint is nothing. It doesn't exist. It's like describing a doorway. A doorway doesn't exist. It's just a hole created by the door frame. So the door frame are the conjoining joints, and the capsule that surrounds it, the wall, that's what we're actually talking about. We want to have a tight joint that will create traction, increase the synovial flow through traction and torque. So that way we're increasing strength of bone, fascia, and muscle while increasing health of the joint, accelerating recovery, and keeping the connective tissue at a stronger level so it pulls back rather than staying loose. Because if you compress a joint and you only compress a joint, what reason is there for the connective tissue, the joint capsule, all of the parts that hold the joint together, what stress is there to make it stronger? None, because it's resting on its own, on its bones, if that makes sense. So the focus of club bell swinging is to complement compressive forces in a way that is health first. And I hope that this has been a thorough enough explanation, because it has in the past seemed antagonistic to compressive lifting. But see, compressive lifting is the doctrinal base. The strategic approach is, okay, I'm going to swing weight. I'm going to use weight swinging in order to cause this traction as well as stimulate the osteoclastic effect, increase muscle and connective tissue stress so that they become stronger. And then at a tactical level, we'll use the club bell because of the profile of the club bell and the way it's constructed. This is really important. Nobody understands the engineering that went involved, because they look at it and say, well, that's just an expensive bat. You don't understand. It was designed by an engineering firm that's in charge of aerospace design. I wanted to make sure that this was the safest, most functional, and most applicable tool for weight swinging as possible. So the profile was completely safe for moving in 6 degrees of freedom or three-dimensional movement in both translation and rotation. And then finally, at a technical level, you have the actual techniques used in order to accomplish that. So to wrap up the question, compressive forces versus tractional forces are the main emphasis. Torque, since we do exist in gravity, torque can also benefit. And torque meaning that the faster you swing a weight, the more that you increase the stress that you can impose upon the body. And what's really interesting is that it's not geometrical, it's nearly exponential. So instead of adding 5 pounds of weight to get 5 pounds more of stress, you swing the weight twice as fast to create 4 times the torque, or 4 times the force production. So it's exponential, nearly. It's not actually from a mathematical engineering standpoint, but it's nearly exponential stress increase. So torque and traction with weight swinging allow you to have the same benefits of compressive forces, but in a health first way, and in a way that you don't have to increase the weight, the true weight of the tool. So you don't need any more equipment other than what it is. And then finally, because you can use torque and traction in 3 dimensions, you can use the club bell in a way that you can't use traditional strength training equipment. And this is the virtue that most people concentrate on. They miss the traction and torque. They don't see those concepts, because it's really the magic behind the mundanity of actually swinging weight. But the most ostensible virtue of club bell swinging is that because of the profile, because of it being swung, and because of the shape and the design and how far the precision in how far the center of mass is distributed from the neck and knob, and the ratio of the neck and knob and barrel and cone, because of that, you can swing it multidimensionally, and I don't mean just triplanar. I mean 6 degrees of freedom. You have 3 degrees of translation, the typical ones, heaving, swaying, and surging, moving forward, backward, right, left, up, down. And then you have 3 degrees of rotation. You have pitching, yawing, and rolling. So bending right, left, bending forward, backward, and twisting right, left. And those are the anatomical degrees of freedom. Each joint has its degree of freedom as well. But just from an anatomical standpoint, you have twice as many movement potentials as triplanar movement when you use degrees of freedom. So the science behind the club bell is just as important as the tool. The point being that you, instead of just the linear movements of traditional weightlifting, because it's swung multidimensionally, you can use the rotary and angular diagonal movements to tap into the body as a synergistic system rather than a segmental isolation, which is typical of bodybuilding and powerlifting. So you can use the entire body in its fascial chain. So you have and we understand this from sports. Athletes and sports performance specialists, they understand that there's only one muscle in the body with hundreds of attachment insertion points. They understand that. But bodybuilding and powerlifting were specifically designed to not recruit. It was the intention to try and isolate. And by doing that, you know, we lose our synergistic potential because the body is the myofascial matrix is greater than the sum of its parts. So when we move rotary or by rotation or angular diagonal, traveling across planes in diagonal arcs, we recruit strength and sling force so that we can retranslate from one tissue to the next in a summation of forces, a sequential summation of forces, they call it in biomechanics, so that you can express power, because that's the main difference between those who live under the auspices of just conventional strength training. They are very powerful in their exercises. In their exercises, their benches, their squats, their deads, their arm curls, their leg curls, their lat delt raises. They're very strong in those exercises. They're powerful. But they lack the ability to express that power athletically or functionally because of the lack of rotary and angular diagonal force expression, which is what a club belt can add to you. So compared to traditional weightlifting, what club bell swinging allows you to do is tap into traction, torque, and three-dimensional movement. And by three-dimensional movement, I mean 6 degrees of freedom, not triplanar. So those are the primary differences. And I want for those people that decided to listen in halfway through the answer to that very long-winded response, I have to reemphasize, this does not mean that you can do that you must not do compressive forces. You can do compressive force if you understand that the focus need be recovering the microtrauma done to the connective tissue at the insertion and attachment points, as well as restoring the fluid body, the synovial fluid and the ground substance flow in between the joints. So you have to decompress the joints and restore the flow in between the bones, around the bones as well. How's that for a response?
I think that's the most thorough answer I've ever heard. All right. Well, I think you answered the first four of my questions right then, actually.
Well, I didn't mean to preempt too much of the interview, but yeah.
All right. Well, how about you just give us a real quick answer for this next one? I'm sure it's easy to answer, but I think it's a common misconception that the club bell is an arm or upper body strengthening tool. Could you expel that myth for us real quick?
Okay, so there are seven key components to club bell swinging. When you're swinging weight, it's very obvious that you need structural integration. When you're weightlifting, it's not so obvious, which is why so many people do weightlifting with poor form. Because it's easy, for instance, to do a back squat incorrectly because of the ability to substitute incorrect muscle contraction. But with weight swinging, it's very obvious that when you use poor form, you can get hurt. For instance, if people that pick up the club bell and they've been doing preacher curls all of their lives, they start to swing it around and they don't have elbow lock. As a result, they get elbow tendonitis because it's constantly pulling away from them while their elbow's locked, so it's not connected to the rest of their body. And the reason that people who look, I mean, they look very athletic. Club bell swinging athletes look very athletic. But they don't look like big, puffy gym bunnies, the typical creatine squishy type of tissue that you look at somebody like, wow, they're really big and they don't really fit in their clothing, but they don't move so well. And I do pick on them because they're causing themselves a great deal of distress and lack of health. So the point being, you need to be able to connect the club bell as an extension of your arm to your core and to your leg drive so that it roots into the earth, which is why, you know, it's martial artists tend to get club bell swinging right away. Fighters tend to get club bell swinging right away because they understand that you can't arm punch an opponent. You need to use your core, you need to use your hips, and you need to hit him with the earth, which means leg drive. So by locking the arms, you connect it, and keeping the shoulders packed, you drop it down so that it's connected to the spine. Having proper spinal alignment allows you to recruit your core so that you can actually use your hips for torque and snap so that you can drive into the earth in order to swing the club bell. Of course, when people pick it up, they think, wow, this is going to build up my forearms. And those guys with the Popeye forearms that waddle around the gym are the people with the least amount of numbers, the lowest numbers when swinging a club bell. And you have a guy like, say, Adam Steer, one of my head coaching staff, who has such a tremendous volume of capacity with power, with force production in club bell swinging because he ties it to his legs and his core and uses his glutes. So he may be, you know, a third the body weight of a typical athlete walking out of a gym, but he can crush them as soon as he starts swinging a club bell because of his ability to express the power throughout his body rather than just grabbing onto it with his forearms, having, you know, getting the forearm pump from having lack of arm lock and lack of proper grip confirmation and not being able to swing more than 5 to 10 reps.
Great, great. That was fantastic. All right, moving on. Do you encounter anyone who would be better served by club bell training than what they're already using, you know, conventional strength training methods?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Would somebody who is involved in a conventional strength training program, you know, something that models a bodybuilding or powerlifting schedule, do you encounter that a lot where there's a better alternative tool than that the club bell can fulfill that purpose? I mean, I know this is an obvious answer here.
You mean, can the club bell substitute for other exercises, or are you asking me, should the club bell be incorporated into pre-existing routines?
The second question.
Okay. There are a lot of people out there that become club bell snobs, and it's easy to do because it's such a fantastic tool that you can do just club bell swinging and get 100% of all of the tension and force production that you need. There's no reason to go to other pieces of equipment. I play with other pieces of equipment personally because, one, I swing club bells almost every day, and I have to be very careful about how much volume I use. And because when I'm demonstrating, I have to show them, okay, this is how it will benefit this exercise. So, or this skill. So I have to learn traditional and non-traditional exercises to show how the club bell and the rest of circular strength training can help that individual. So it's very easy to become a CST snob, but that would be self-defeating. You wouldn't be able to help anyone else. What you should be able to do, and what my CST coaches and head coaches, especially the faculty, are specialists at, is demonstrating how one or two or several exercises incorporated into a cycle will allow them, allow the prospective client or the athlete to increase their total functionality and total performance while increasing their health and decreasing their pain. So it's understanding the target skill that you want to enhance or the deficit in particular motion that the individual hasn't been utilizing. So if they're a non-competing athlete, if they don't compete, I think anybody that exercises is an athlete and should treat themselves as such. So when I say athlete, I also include everyone that doesn't compete in a sport. The movements that they're not having are the ones where they're going to get injured, are the ones that are hemorrhaging their power. There's only so many movements the body is capable of. It's an infinite amount, but there are only so many movements that you can train. So you have to be training the functional opposite in the next cycle. That's where club bell swinging can help, because it is definitely the most versatile tool there is. If you incorporate it effectively and just get guidance from a trained professional, so that if you understand the science behind it, you've studied rigorously, you could probably pull it off on your own. But I've been doing this longer than anyone. I've broken the records in club swinging that were excellent, and I still have a coach watch me whenever I train, because I know that when you get to a certain point biochemically, you start to get, you know, that starry-eyed Twitter-painted thing, and, you know, the endocrine system starts kicking in, you have nice feel-good chemicals going through your body, and you might not start paying attention to form. I'm a notorious cheater, and I believe in being highly efficient, because the body's designed that way, and efficiency isn't always the best thing, because you'll find the efficient groove when you should be trying to make it harder on you, not easier. And that if you make it easier on you, it's because you may be substituting tissues that shouldn't be incorporated at the time. So I have a coach watch me when I start pushing the envelope, when I start going near the edge. Get a trained professional to, even if it's just a half an hour consultation, to give you feedback on your current program so that you can learn how to incorporate club bell training with one or two exercises just to start. And see the effects. After 2 or 3 weeks, you'll be amazed at how rapid the learning curve is, amazed at how fast it will translate over onto the field, onto the mat, in the ring, whatever your sport may be. Or most importantly, if you're a non-competing athlete, if you just want to be functionally fit and healthy, you'll see the difference in how you move, the ease with which you're able to accomplish daily activities, and the lack of the niggling, nagging pains and aches that you get from just going to the gym and enduring compressive forces, like, you know, the little elbow tendonitis, the shoulder bursitis, the little neck stingers, the pinched behind the shoulder blades, the lower back ache, the tightness that you get, or the little bit of knee strain and ankle strain. All of those things. And I know this is a bit heretical to say, but all of those things can be prevented. They can be prevented, and they're specifically caused because of not incorporating effective tractional and torsional three-dimensional movement that club bell swinging can do.
Awesome. All right. Well, let's transition into some Prasara questions. And I remember from last call you mentioned that Prasara yoga is not yoga for sissies, it's not granola, it's something that will have you sweating in under a minute. So I'm really looking forward to this. So what would be the difference between a bodyweight exercise and a biomechanical exercise from your Body Flow or Prasara yoga programs?
That's a good question. All right, so a bodyweight exercise is done specifically for one purpose, and that's volume. You're doing it for repetition. By repeating a particular movement, you're causing a specific adaptation. Makes sense. The only problem with a bodyweight exercise is that it's typically designed to concentrate on specific tissues. For instance, a traditional push-up. Traditional push-up, even with proper form, you look at the people that are push-up gurus. Even with proper form, if you do any specific exercise to the exclusion of its functional opposite, of its complementary movement, you will eventually have diminishing returns, plateau, regress, pain, injury, illness, and death. And it's always in that process. It will always happen. Specific adaptation to imposed demand will create over-specializations and overcompensations that will eventually lead to injury. You prepared the injury. Nothing ever just happens to your body. You specifically caused it. It's your fault. And the greater accountability you have to your exercise, the less likely that will happen. You can't blame the exercise. You can't blame the exercise. It's like having a pet snake and expecting it not to eventually bite you. It's a snake. You can't perform an exercise over and over and over again, but you get greedy. You get greedy. You get results. You get fast results in the first 2 weeks to 2 months. And you keep on pushing because, I had such great results for it. I don't want to lose the results. Well, guess what? You have to lose the results. You must. You only get to keep 25 to 35% of your results from the prior cycle from a body weight exercise. The rest you must let go of because you need to compensate and release all of the adhesions that result from repeating something over and over again, all the little microtrauma. A body flow exercise or a biomechanical exercise is designed to release adhesions. And adhesions are, so if you have the fascial bag's holding the muscle, that electric goo we love to play with. The fascial bag will touch another fascial bag. Or it'll touch the inner bag, the joint capsule, the periosteum. And where it doesn't move, it'll form adhesions. It'll form little leathery collagenous fibers that creep over and get really intimate and want to hug tight because the body always adapts. It just knows what you've asked it to do. And if you do a body weight exercise over and over and over again, then what happens? Sure, you get the increases in strength and power and speed, endurance, whatever. But also, since it's only a movement, you can't train your muscles. You can only train a movement. There's no such thing as muscle building. There's only movement development or motor development. So as you do that specific motor pattern, there are certain tissues that stay in constant relationship. So let's say you're doing your push-up. Now, what doesn't you see the actors? You see the movement actors. You see the elbow pitching. You see the bicep flexion and extension. You see the pecs incorporating so that they can generate the power. You see the core tighten and keep hold so that the body becomes lighter. The tighter the body is, the lighter. But what you don't see is where the tissues are immobile, where you fix them in place so that you can accomplish the repetitive volume. Those tissues remain constant and remain fixed, and they adapt as well to hold that structure in place. So as you clench your thighs and your glutes, they remain held in isometric contraction, and the small tissues there become very fibrous and conjoined. They form adhesions. They become tight. If you see someone, like when you walk up to me and you grab a hold of my body, you put your hand on my shoulder, you give me a hug. You can squeeze my muscles down to the bone. They move out of the way. I don't have a hard body. You grab a hold of a bodybuilder, and it's like grabbing hold of a brick. It's not merely the muscle, the residual muscle tension, which is a problem in and of itself. It's the leathery adaptation of the fascia, which becomes fixed in place because of their notion of isolation. They force the body or pretend that the body can't act systemically. They make it segmental movements. So they become very hard. So a body weight exercise is going to do this. It's going to create adhesions. A biomechanical exercise is designed to absorb and retranslate force. So it releases the adhesions and then takes the force by increasing the rubber band-like elasticity of the connective tissue and then lets it erupt out a different direction. So you could think of it, so people that haven't done CST before, you could think of it as somebody throwing a medicine ball at you. You catch the medicine ball with both hands to your chest, one leg back, straddle stance, and immediately you throw the ball to the side with one palm driving. You throw it at a 90-degree angle to and hit the wall with the ball. the medicine ball. So you've absorbed it into the rear leg. You've loaded the rear leg, and then you immediately use hip snap to translate that elasticity, and I'll let it erupt out of the body to the opposite direction. Now, yes, you could do that biomechanical exercise repetitively. You could do that repetitively. But that's not the focus. The focus is to continue that motor development of allowing the adhesions to not form and to increase the tensile strength, the elasticity of the connective tissue so that you're able to express power. When in express power, we mean the ability to absorb and retranslate force. Body weight exercises and biomechanical exercises are they can overlap like a Venn diagram, because as you get increased motor sophistication in a biomechanical exercise, for instance, as you move from a traditional push-up into, say, a plyometric push-up or a circular push-up where you move over to one hand, press up with wide stance on the hands, move to the other hand. Now you're creating a biomechanical exercise. You're absorbing and retranslating force. So it's a Venn diagram. As you increase motor sophistication, that movement becomes a biomechanical exercise. And that's really the prescriptive approach that I use in circular strength training, and all my faculty and head coaches and coaching staff are trained to do. They go in, they see your traditional program, and they give you motor sophistication. There's no such thing as general fitness. So knowing that's true, and we talked about that last time, knowing that you can't be generally fit, you can only ever be specifically fit, if you're only doing a body weight exercise repetitively, then you're over-specializing. And that over-specialization, if it hasn't already begun to give you little pains and aches, it will. And what comes after that is injury. Because those exercises are designed to sophisticate, but we keep them simple, stupid, unfortunately. And that's what happens to our body. It becomes stupidly simplistic. We can't absorb and retranslate force. So we come in, we show you how you can progress the motor sophistication of the exercises that you're doing up into a peaking pyramid, and then recycle out of that into doing the functional opposite in the next cycle so that you can keep that balance. I hope that was thorough enough.
Oh, very thorough. Now, I have another follow-up question. Would a biomechanical exercise complement a bodyweight exercise, much like traction training complements compressive training?
A biomechanical, yes, first of all. But not in a parallel way, in a hierarchical way. So a bodyweight exercise, if done correctly, progresses upward in motor sophistication and becomes a biomechanical exercise. Because as you start to work on localized strength deficits and you increase their contractibility, your muscle activation, that's a bodyweight exercise. A bodyweight exercise is designed to reactivate and increase local strength deficits. Then, as you recover that, reactivate that tissue, and the strength returns, then the goal is to take that force that you've generated and weave it into the tapestry of your overall functional fitness. You increase the motor sophistication of it. Like I said, you know, the traditional push-up progresses onto the screwing push-up or the gear push-up or the plyometric clapping push-up. Or the circular push-up, those are the next steps, and then it should even sophisticate out of merely push-up. It should go into a quad squat. It should continue in its motor sophistication. So it's sequential rather than parallel. The body weight exercise is designed to move upward in sophistication to biomechanical exercises.
Okay. All right. Now, how did body flow ultimately evolve into Prasari yoga?
Well, okay. So body flow was basically my experience in the former Soviet Union, learning their approach. And even though I translated it as biomechanical exercise, because of the different scientific environment of the USA, biomechanical exercises, it doesn't really translate correctly. Because we have notions of what biomechanics is, and we have notions of what exercises are. But Let's just say they did something called biomechanical exercise. And this was the ability to absorb and retranslate force. And there were different approaches to it. You have back shaping or reverse engineering that's now become popular in U.S. baseball and other sports as well, of starting with the final component of a skill and then working backwards in order to not only have a proprioceptive imprint of where the final movement should conclude, but also in strengthening the functional opposite. So it derives out of sports performance potential in the former Soviet Union. Body flow does. Now, the problem with body flow is that people will see it and they will only do it and they'll turn it into a body weight exercise. So they'll do repetition after repetition after repetition, not realizing that the movement doesn't go to its apogee. It's not, there isn't a point where you're getting complete release when you're doing a body flow exercise or a biomechanical exercise. When you only do it, when you do it repetitiously, you can create the same overspecialization that you would with the body weight exercise. See, this is where semantics is really killing me. You can, by doing a body biomechanical exercise repetitiously, you dumb it down into a body weight exercise. It's supposed to cycle out, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So what happened was, after my experience in Russia, I began my training with Indian disciplines, and I realized that what was missing was the apogee of release. So let's say in a dive bomber exercise, and dive bomber is like a body weight swoop into a push-up, basically. If people don't know what a dive bomber is, just Google it. Now, a dive bomber is basically a variation, a derivation of a very ancient exercise deriving from yoga. And that's a upward-facing dog into a downward-facing dog, back into an upward-facing dog. The problem with the two approaches is that the westernized version of yoga lacks sufficient tension and athletic performance. It doesn't have the biomechanical exercises' ability to absorb and retranslate force, which is why most yogis and yoginis couldn't fight their way out of a wet paper death trap. They just, you know, I see them and I just want to give them a sandwich and give them a hug. Because they don't have the ability to express power. Their bodies are completely relaxed, but there's no such thing as relaxation. Relaxation is just proper lack of unnecessary tension. If you live a functional life, where in daily life you need the ability to recruit tension, or if you're athletic at all, you need the ability to express power. Old yogis, and I say westernized yogis that way, old yogis, they were lifting weights. They were swinging weights. They would do their yoga with stone rings around their neck, with ultra heavy clubs, like we do. They would do it with logs that had handles cut out in them, like strongmen now do. There are many different types of tools that were used, but that's been excised from yoga because it's more PC to view yoga as crunchy granola rather than something that kicks your ass. So to get back to the point, the other end of the spectrum then is that biomechanical exercises lacked the full movement of release. So as you do that dive bomber, you don't have the full upward-facing dog and downward-facing dog in order to give the complementary opposite release to prevent the adhesions to be forming. And that's what's unique about yoga, and that's where the whole notion of functional opposites training came from. They call it complementary poses, but it's not done that way. I mean, in the West, yoga is pretty awful. And I'm not speaking about all yogis. If they're going to get into a chant revolt against me because I'm saying that they're awful, that's, you know, too bad. The point being that it's supposed to have every every pose should have a complementary opposite, a complementary pose that balances it out. So every upward-facing dog should have a downward-facing dog. And by having those complementary poses included in the dive bomber, for instance, then you have a balanced exercise that gives you the ability to absorb and retranslate force while at the same time in the movement releasing the adhesions which may be forming, increasing myofascial density because of not releasing the residual muscle tension. You can release those in advance so that you don't become thick and leathery and only powerful in exercise. You then become powerful in the ability to express the force as well.
Okay. Well, I got two more questions about Prasara, and spend as much time as you want on them. First, what are some of the major differences between Prasara and other popular types of yoga? I know this is a hard question to answer because yoga has been, modernized in our Western culture, but, what are some of the differences between Prasara and Hatha, Vinyasa, Bikram? What makes it unique?
Well, Hatha Yoga is the overarching term. Hatha Yoga is physical yoga or Raja Yoga. So it's all any physical form of yoga. Well, I shouldn't say any physical form. The physical forms that are typical, like Prasara is a physical form of yoga. It's a Hatha Yoga. Okay. So that's first of all. Second of all, when you're talking about Bikram Yoga is a set of 27 poses done in specific sequence, done for a specific purpose, and unless you understand that purpose, you probably shouldn't be participating in it. For instance, Bikram was a competitive bodybuilder when he was young, and his goal was to prove the effectiveness of yoga for his family. It was a crusade for him. So he developed a yoga which he became very effective at, which increased his health, increased his range of motion. He still had that beautiful physique of bodybuilders, but his yoga was perfect. And why? He won't admit this. I'm sure he wouldn't. And I don't disrespect him for it. I do respect him for it. What he doesn't realize is that he created a specific yoga approach, a prescription of yoga poses, which complement. They're the complementary opposite of bodybuilding. That's why you see the lack of, say, bicep tension and chest tension, for instance, just as an example, in any of the Bikram poses that were selected and in the sequence that was chosen. And that all of the poses in it were chosen for the specific reason of releasing the opposite motion of what you would find in Western culture. Because fitness in this culture is typically amateur bodybuilding, if that makes sense. And hopefully people will grasp the cultural context of why his selection process evolved. Inductively, he's just going to find the exercises that complement the discipline that he was immersed in, bodybuilding. And that's why it accelerated, one of the reasons that it accelerated in its popularity so much. Compare that with Prasara Yoga. Prasara Yoga is one modality of yoga. You have three modes. You have asana, vinyasa, and prasara. All three modes, like a Venn diagram, are designed to act interactively to accelerate your flow, your motor sophistication, and the quality or efficiency of movement that you have. So asana is designed to strengthen the structural deficits of connective tissue lacking strength. The vinyasa is designed for you to reteach you how to breathe in between movements. So as you breathe from one posture to the next. And then prasara is designed to increase the efficiency and maintenance of tension in between poses. So if you look at a typical flow yoga class or a typical vinyasa, they do perform a chain of poses where you move in between them. But as you move in between them, you you sacrifice the quality of movement. And even though they become very graceful at it, the point about Prasara Yoga is that it teaches us that there's always vinyasa and there's always asana. I mean, there's always structural integrity and there's always breath integration. That's what Prasara is designed to teach. There's no point in time where you're jumping from one post to the next. That's the focus of Prasara. So it's a modality rather than a style. And that's where it differs, say, from Bikram. Bikram is a style of yoga. It's a selection of specific poses that are performed over and over again for a specific intent, whether doctrinally overt or not. It's designed as the complement to bodybuilding, which is why it's very helpful for most people, because they do bodybuilding. But if you stop bodybuilding, then the Bikram yoga wouldn't have as much as dramatic effect for them as it because what they're doing is they're recovering from the adverse impact of trying to do bodybuilding in order to become fit. I'd say stop both. But if you're going to do both, then love it. I'm not trying to convert people. So Prasara yoga is a modality rather than a style, if that makes sense. And Prasara is not to be done to the exclusion of vinyasa or breath linkage and asana or structural integration.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. All right, now, from a more practical standpoint, what is the scope of Prasara yoga? What can it be used for?
Mastering your physical...
Besides everything.
Well, the point about Prasara yoga is that for a CST coach and head coach, it is a repository of movements that can be used as functional opposites to create a balanced personal training program or sports performance program. It's a toolbox. But for the average individual, you don't need to know any of the science behind it. You don't need to know why it works, how it works, or what it does. If you follow the Series A flows, starting with flow fit and mastering it, developing your B-breathe, and then finally recruiting forward pressure and moving into the Series A flows under instruction, then you're learning to master the epicenter of all sports, the mecca of all functional purpose, which is yourself. You master your physical motor sophistication. You become graceful yourself. You can do anything, and that's really the focus of it. It takes your body through all of the potential degrees of freedom in each joint, increases the ability to absorb and retranslate force, increases your ability to efficiently recruit your breath so that you can express power not just in the localized portion of your body where you're touching another object, but from your core to the earth. And finally, it keeps you in balance so that you're exploring your intuitive awareness of what your potential is. So when I say it's for mastering yourself, I don't mean that in the cheeky way that most martial artists or yogis will say in a very aloof way of not understanding what's going on. I'm saying that because if you look at someone who practices CST for a couple years, they can walk into any sport or activity, look at the skill, internalize it, and refine it at such a rapid rate, maybe a tenth of the duration needed to learn the new skill, not because of some magic pill in CST. The magic pill in CST is the way that it turns the focus back on your motor sophistication rather than on the exercise. The exercise doesn't mean they don't mean jack. The point of the exercise is to return your intuitive awareness to the internal experience of movement and breath and structure. So you end up mastering yourself. And if you master yourself, like Musashi wrote about, master one thing and you master 10,000 or an infinity. By mastering your own movement potential, you become capable of dissecting any skill very rapidly and being able to refine it to a high degree at an expedient rate. So the whole focus of Prasara is really upon masterful flow of yourself.
Okay. All right, well, we've covered the three wings of CST in depth. We've talked about joint mobility, club bell athletics, and Prasara yoga. Can you just explain what the three wings of CST could look like in a complete holistic fitness program. And maybe touch on the 4x7 training format, too, while you're at it.
Okay. I'll try and do this succinctly. In any personal training program, what do you have? You have a warm-up, you have the work, and you have a cool-down. So in CST, the three rings are integrated in that format. For the warm-up, you use joint mobility to prime the acting joints through their full range of motion so that you have full lubrication and dynamic flexibility, increased circulation. For the performance of the work, which comes next, the exercise, and in the exercise portion, you go through all 6 degrees of freedom, you select one exercise per degree of freedom. So you have a, let's say you have a squat, you have a front lunge, you have a side lunge, you have a roll, like a overhead side bend with dumbbells or medicine ball, where you're bending right and left. You have a pitch, like a good morning press or an RDL, a Romanian deadlift. And you have a yaw, which is like a Russian twist or a med ball twist sitting on a bazoo ball, right? So there you have a heave this way, a surge, a pitch, a yaw, and a roll. And you have one exercise per degree of freedom. And then finally, and your mobility, your warm-up, specifically looks at the acting joints of those six exercises and dissects them, which is what my coaching staff is. They're specifically trained to do, which is why I kick their ass, you know, not just physically but mentally and emotionally, so that they can internalize this at a rapid rate and be able to, you know, have prescriptive identification of movements right away. I give them a time limit of 7 minutes to be able to create programs when they do an interview. At 7 minutes is when they have to be able to finish it by. And 7 minutes is a long time. My coaches and head coaches have to do it in two. That's how fast. And I'm also including the interview process. And then finally, the cool-down. The cool-down is to select the specific compensatory movements which will unload the functional opposite of the work that has been recruited in the 6 degrees of freedom. So let's say in the squat, the heave, the complementary or functional opposite of the heave would, say, be an upward facing dog, so you can release the hip flexors, which might have muted function from repetitively performing the squat from the hip pitch of the legs. So you have to unload the functional opposite of it. So the cool down exercises are selected in such a way that they are designed specifically to unload the functional opposite of the work that had been done. So a CST program is elegant. It's not some kind of montage of, I'll do this and that. No. Weakness cannot hide from a CST program, from a personal training program. And even the group exercise classes that are now being taught all around the country and world, in Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, they're on waiting list only. And that's how popular they are, because people feel good after them. Sure, they look great. I don't care about how they look, though. That's a byproduct of doing a proper program. They feel fantastic. They leave the program with more energy than when they started. That's why people come up to me raving about the CST group exercise class. The DVD is actually coming out this week. And it's in this elegant format that is not done anywhere else. It's trademark proprietary, because people don't know how to do it and shouldn't try and tinker with it. They just appreciate it. And if you want to learn how to do the process correctly, then come to a CST seminar. Because really, the focus of it is owning the movement. A lot of personal training certification seminars out there, especially even national and international accreditation bodies, are done by filling out a multiple choice test, which you can do even online. That's deplorable. When they shouldn't be preachers, they should be teachers. They should understand what's going to happen in the prospective client's body, because they've done it themselves and mastered it to a high degree. that they know all of the potential hazards that could happen because they've explored them themselves. You can't take somebody where you haven't been or give them something you don't have. And that's why the CST class design is very specific. It guarantees success to the 98% of people who aren't genetically predisposed to being successful at a particular exercise, which is like, for instance, the bench press. 2% of the population can lift bench presses without any threat of injury for the rest of their lives. And those are the exceptions that people point to when the research comes out of saying the dangers of bench press. Well, look at this person. He's been bench pressing and he's 85. Yeah? Show me 1,000 of those 85-year-olds that are still doing it. Now, what about 30 million, the number of people involved in fitness? That's what I'm concerned about. I don't care about the one individual who can, you know, smoke all of his life and have his 40 every day and still be able to outrun people who are in their 20s. I don't care about him. I care about me, the shallow end of the gene pool, people like me. I want them to be successful, and that's what the focus of that specific elegant program design is. 4x7 is a very long topic. I think we should maybe think about that for a future interview because I could. It takes a lot of time to set up why it is the way it is in order for it to make sense.
Okay.
And there are a lot of unstated questions which result once you start talking about a four-day cycle rather than a week cycle, which is how most people train. They train on a work week, 5 days on, 2 days off. So let's bridge that question another time.
Okay, that's fine. Well, that was the last official question I had. But I did want to ask, you know, since you did share a lot of information with us and it can be a little overwhelming, let's say someone is interested in pursuing something we talked about, whether on this call or the last one, joint mobility, club bell training. What would be the best thing that they could do today to begin learning and applying CST for themselves?
Well, let's say your gym membership is $1,500. $1,500 a year. That's pretty meager gym membership. People are cutting back. They're trying to downsize their financial expenditures to recession-proof their fitness. Well, think of investing a few hundred dollars for the rest of your life, for the rest of your life, a few hundred dollars, not every year, but for the rest of your life, invest in the three books, the three central books of CST, or one of them, whichever direction is most intriguing to you. Free to Move, if you want to learn about mobility, the big book of club bell training, obviously for club bell training, and Prasara Yoga or Prasara Yoga. And then also there's a companion